Danny Kane's been fishing since he could walk. He used to run trout lines with his dad.
I got tired of hustling bait for trout lines. Buddy and I got some nets, and we thought we were going to catch a lot of fish. We didn't catch nothing.
That didn't stop Danny, though. He learned to make nets by hand, and he's been net fishing now for 40 years. This week on Interstates, Danny Kane walks Violet Barron through the process of making fishing nets by hand. They also talk about invasive species like Asian carp and how they're kind of an acquired taste. Then we listen back to a 2016 interview with Peter Lopilato, founder of the Rider film series and magazine. He passed away on March 7th. That's all coming up after this. It was almost a quarter century ago that I went to this movie. It was a David Lynch film. I'd seen Blue Velvet, so I had a sense of what to expect. But I wasn't really prepared. Mulholland Drive was crazy. There was this one scene in particular that where this sort of death figure comes out from behind a dumpster, and I jumped out of my seat. That scene is bound up with the place where I saw it. It was at Bear's Place, which was this restaurant and bar and jazz club, and they did other things just on the edge of Indiana University campus here in Bloomington. And the whole reason I was able to see Mulholland Drive, which was this sort of weird art film that wasn't probably being shown in the AMC theater, was because it was being shown as part of this film series here in town. If you're from here, you know what I'm talking about. It's the Rider film series. When I saw Mulholland Drive at Bear's Place, probably with a beer in hand, the Rider series had already been going on for over 20 years. It was already a cultural institution, and that's part of what I want to think about today in this episode is cultural institutions and what they do for a place. And I don't mean cultural institutions like the university or, you know, maybe a big church or the New Yorker magazine or the symphony that has a lot of money, if your town's symphony has a lot of money. Really, I'm interested in these little sort of niche cultural institutions that end up being really important for the community. The Rider is one of those cultural institutions in Bloomington. It's a film series that's been going on since 1979. It's also this magazine that you can pick up for free in coffee shops and elsewhere around town. It's got an events calendar and articles written by local people about local arts and culture. This most recent issue has tips for the eclipse and an article explaining the problem with building more jails and prisons, and more. Anyway, the reason I'm talking about the Rider is that its founder, Peter Lopilato, he was listed as both the Alpha and the Omega in the magazine's masthead. He passed away last week due to complications from some long-standing health issues. He was really beloved in the community, so I want to replay an interview Yael Cassander did with Peter in 2016 for WFIU's Profiles. They talk about how Peter put Bloomington on the national cinematic map, the Wild West of Bloomington's 1970s art scene, the audible gasp when people saw Donna Reed in It's a Wonderful Life for the very first time, and more. One of the things I find most impressive about Peter is his ability to create these two institutions, the magazine and the film series, that he sustained for decades. They've both been around for over 40 years now. So we'll listen to Yael's conversation with Peter, but first we're going to consider another kind of cultural institution. It's about the kinds of traditions that get passed down from one person to the next, even if sometimes it takes a grant from an institution to keep that tradition going. Producer Violet Barron talked with Danny Kane about making fishing nets by hand. Here's Violet.
The filmmaker Hannah Lindgren's 2022 documentary, The Net Makers, featured Danny Kane and Larry Haycraft, two fishermen who craft their own fishing nets to catch catfish in the rivers of rural southern Indiana. The film shows the men at work, fishing on small motorized boats, and at home, hand-tying thousands of intricate knots to make the huge hoop nets. I visited Danny at his home in New Harmony to hear more of his story. What got you into it?
I've been fishing since I could walk with my dad, and he would run trot lines. Put 50 hooks on every trot line, and he might put out 6 to 8 trot lines. And once we got old enough, us kids went and got the bait. And I got tired of hustling bait for trot lines, and Buddy and I got some nets, and we thought we was going to catch a lot of fish. We dropped them in the river. We didn't catch nothing. And Jim Cooper seen us one day, and he told us, "You fools, you're fishing the wrong place." And he helped us out. And since then, I've been net fishing now for 40-some years. Jim Cooper's my mentor. He taught me to make nets. He got a grant from university to teach me and Timmy Durham how to make nets. And as far as I know, we're both still making nets. I haven't talked to Timmy in several years.
And what was it like learning from Jim how to do it? Because it's if you're not used to it, it's a whole new world, right?
Yeah, it's boring as all get out, really. Mm-hmm. You tie one knot 5,000 or 6,000 times or more. That's it. It's just repetition of one knot over and over and over. You got a gauge or a block that you that gives you your size of your webbing. And just wrap around that, tie a knot, and do that over and over and over. So, then you got, you know, your take-ups and all this, it's still the same knot. He gave me the nets at first, and he showed me how to use them. He said, he told me I was dumber than all get out. He said, "You don't know what you're doing." And he's right. He showed me where to fish and all this, and I went with him to run his nets. I learned from that, and after that, it's just trial and error.
Trial and error, meaning sometimes you can make those knots correctly and sometimes you have to fix them?
Yeah. If you don't get the knot right, you got to untie it. If you make a mistake, I got a rule. You untie back to that mistake. My son-in-law untied 41 mash, two knots to a mash. I think it was 81 around. To correct a mistake. He did not make that mistake again. So you learn, you know, I still make mistakes, but I can tie my way out of them now. We buy the webbing in a sheet. You buy it by the pound. And we cut it out. He showed me how to cut out what I needed, how to tie it together, and how to start my throats. I could tie knots while I'm talking to you right here. I've just done so many of them. I know, you know, my hands know what to do. I don't. My hands do. I just keep going round and round and round. Yep. Sit here, watch TV, talk to my wife.
Yeah, you got a nice big screen propped against the wall, so yeah. You've got it all set up here. Plus, you've got a glove. Does it rip up your hands if after a while?
Yes, it does. And this glove will make about three nets.
Oh, before it gets all ripped up.
Yeah. I sit here like this.
Yanking it tight.
Yes, that is tight. I'm doing a take up right now. And I'm making sure I'm doing it right because I don't want to untie it. Now, here's where we come up to the pig string.
Did you say pig string?
Yes.
What's that?
Just the name Cooper gave it. Just a string that hangs down to...
Oh, I see that other dangling shuttle, yeah.
That's what this is.
I'm worried you're going to call me in like 2 weeks and say, "You know what? I made a mistake when we were together. Now I have to start over." But you've been doing this a long time.
Over 30 years. You can see here on this net, this where I
on the glove.
Pull the string on the glove, we're starting to wear right there. And I just bought this glove. If you know anybody that only needs a left-hand glove, I got a bunch of them. It's a losing proposition. I've sold maybe 6 or 7 nets in my life because people come up and they want 5 or 6 nets today. It'll take me a year to make 5 or 6 nets in my spare time. But they can call this net company, tell them what they want, and they ship them out tomorrow.
But selling the fish that you catch in those nets, is that the main business for you, or it has been?
It has been in the past, yes, but not anymore. The Asian carp are killing off all the little fish. I keep the buffalo and the catfish.
The Asian carp are crowding them out now.
They're starving them out. Asian carp lives off of plankton. It's a little microorganism that all baby fish need. If you don't have babies, you don't have adults. There's no predator for them. Nothing eats the minnows. There's no predator to slow them down. Now, I've ate it, and it's a better tasting fish than the catfish.
But it's very bony, right? It's difficult to skin.
Yes, they're very difficult. I got to find, there's a spot in there where you can get the flay out of it. I just got to find this, how to get it out.
And so if you're learning this year how to do it, then that might be a change for you, right?
Yeah, I'd be fishing for them because there's, leave the, what catfish are out there. When I get done, and I've done it right, it's a beautiful net. I have actually hung them up in the front yard, and my son thought I had a Christmas tree in my front yard. Then he had to think, he said, Dad doesn't have a tree there. Hung a net up, put lights on it. Everybody thinks you got a Christmas tree.
What was that like for you being part of the Netmakers documentary?
I was real interested in that, and I enjoyed doing it. Sometimes it's hard to explain, you know, to someone who doesn't know what I'm doing. Like I tell you, I fillet the fish. You don't know what I'm talking about. What I'm doing, I'm cutting the meat off the bone. And then it's got a red meat on the outside of it. We cut this off. Makes a better tasting meat. We went out on a river and showed them how it was done. Showed them the Asian carp. As soon as they jump in the boat, they start bleeding. They see enough of them in a heartbeat. After we got through running nets on the river, we came back, and I cooked fish for everybody but Hannah. She's a vegetarian. She don't eat fish. Didn't bother us. We ate the fish.
You mentioned that you did do an apprenticeship, right, where you taught someone how to do that. Was that your son-in-law or someone else?
My son-in-law and my nephew both.
Did it remind you of when you were learning?
Yes. Yeah.
Were they different at all? Is this generation a little less patient?
My son-in-law, they're both still making nets. My son-in-law tied his totally. And he told me when he finishes this net, he's going to order webbing. He said, I'm tired of tying them. The way he works, he can't fish. He works 4 days, 12 hours.
Sounds like long hours. Doesn't give you a lot of free time to be out on the water, right?
Yeah, because by law, you have to run them every 48 hours. In the summertime, water's hot. You have to run them every 48 hours or you lose all your fish. They'll die. This time of year, you could actually get by running once a week and the fish will still be alive, still be in good shape. Fish are like you and I. They're not going out here in the middle of the stream, walking against the wind or what have you. You can just go over here where it's something blocking it a little bit. They're taking it easy. If it gets hot, they want to be cool. So they go deep. And when it gets cold, they come up. There's a warm layer in there.
And is anybody you know, like, learning right now, in the process of learning as a new student?
No, I'm looking.
Yeah.
My other son-in-law, he said he knows some guys that might be interested, but he hasn't got back with me yet.
Do you think it's going to continue, this craft?
No. Not unless we find a way to eat the Asian carp. And when you say carp, 90% of the people, I ain't eating that.
Because it's so hard to flay.
It's got so many bones in it. We're too lazy to pick around them.
Do you think we could learn?
Yeah, I feed them.
And you said the meat's actually good.
Yeah. I've ate the Asian carp. Guy over at Grayville took over Fish Market after John Farmer died, and he was cooking Asian carp. And three of us went over to try it. And we all got our catfish and our other stuff and one or two pieces of Asian carp. When we went back for seconds, we didn't get any catfish. We got Asian carp.
Interesting. Do you think that there can be like a process to make the filleting part easier because they're so bony?
I don't know. I'm going to find out. This is a finished net.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. There's a whole lot of knots on the outside.
It's a white net with green hoops keeping the shape, and it's got sort of two layers of funnels, net funnels, yeah, inside it.
Two funnels.
So it guides the fish in, and then it's very hard for them to get out of there.
Yeah,
right?
Your first throat is a starter. All it does is start the fish up in the net. And your second one is a keeper.
Mm. Yeah, it looks
Once
like a keeper.
Once they get in, they can't get out.
It's a fish motel.
Yeah. Now, those two hanging on the wall there are 6 foot.
And they're darker. They look a little older. Are they older?
They are. I don't fish them anymore. Mm-hmm. I can't fish them anymore. I'm not strong enough anymore to work them and all this.
Mm-hmm. But I guess they would get a big yield, right?
Last time I had it out, had 358 pound of buffalo in it.
Wow. And buffalo is the kind of fish.
Yeah.
And that's a black color. Or
it's a tar on them. Uh-huh. That preserves them in the water. Makes it easier to clean the trash off. And the fish don't get tangled up in it as quick. This preserves the string. Okay. You put nylon string out in the sunlight, and it deteriorates quickly.
Okay, so this keeps it strong. There was a funny moment in that presentation at IU when you and Larry were talking about the cheese that you use.
Yeah.
Do you mind just sort of telling about that cheese?
Okay, the cheese I have, scrap cheese from the cheese factories, okay? It's been sitting out there in my barn in a barrel for about 3 years.
Yum.
Yeah, that's not the word for it. We bait it with our hands. We don't wear gloves. And it stinks. And it does not come off your hands. Unless you use toothpaste. Anything that stinks. The more it stinks, the more they like it. Now, this is the cheese.
Oh, wow.
You smell it already, don't you?
I do. Doesn't look like food. Wow.
I put the cheap dog food in it to soak up the water.
I
got
see.
Cheese in this barrel, that barrel, and this one.
Hmm. Yeah, so you've got three barrels, like plastic barrels,
yeah.
And it just looks like brown sludge.
I used liver one time. The reason I say one time, when I brought it up off the bottom of the river after being out there for 2 days, I almost lost my lunch. And I had to dump his stuff out of a bag. But I caught fish. Used to, when I was fishing, I'm gonna say 30 years ago, I knew about 8 commercial fishermen in this area. I know 2 now.
Right. People are just moving away from it. They're doing something else.
We're dying off. Most of them died off.
And new people didn't take it on.
Young people ain't interested in it. I don't sell fish to anybody under 40 years old.
They buy it at the market or something.
Yeah. And if they knew what they was eating, they wouldn't buy it. It's swai. It comes from Vietnam.
Why do you think they're doing that, though? Convenience?
Convenience and ease. I mean, I can go to Farm Boy, buy a box of fish, fillets. I'm going to say $3, $4 a pound. I really don't know. And fry them up, and some people like them. I don't eat them.
Danny Kane, netmaker, in conversation with producer Violet Barron. If you want to get a visual sense of the process, check out the film The Netmakers by Hannah Lindgren. All right, it's time for a break. When we come back, we'll listen to Yael Cassander's conversation with Peter Lopilato. Peter was the alpha and omega of the writer film series and magazine here in Bloomington. He passed away on March 7th. Welcome back to Interstates. Let's get right into Yael Cassander's conversation with Peter Lopilato, recorded in 2016.
It's an honor to have you in the studio today, Peter.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So last summer, a piece in the LA Times lamented that a certain French film that had done well at the Cannes Film Festival never made it to Los Angeles, but it had been screened in Bloomington, Indiana for a week. And the writer wrote, with typical coastal elitism, I might add, quote, "It's long been known that the art house scene in Los Angeles lags behind that of New York, but must we be outdone by Iowa City and Bloomington as well?" Unquote. So I was proud to read that we had outdone Los Angeles cinematically. And I also, of course, wondered whether you had in fact been the one to show the film.
Yeah, sure. The film is a 3-hour French film called Little Quinquin. And we showed it for, I think we did 6 screenings.
Well, bravo. I think this is a great opportunity to reflect on your role in terms of the cultural evolution of Bloomington. How did you choose the film, and how, in general, do you go about choosing your films?
I get screeners. Now everything is digital. There are secure websites. They send me passwords. And films that are playing at festivals or films that are opening in New York or occasionally Los Angeles, I can watch online, perhaps a week or two before they open. So that's I used to go to New York City, and I would just go to the theaters and see as many films as I possibly could in the 10 days or so that I would be there. But now, with chauffeuring around 2 kids, et cetera, it's a little bit easier to just watch them online.
Did you see that mention in the LA Times, or did someone point it out to you?
A couple of people sent it to me.
What was your first response?
Well, it was nice to see that at least somebody recognized that we were doing some interesting programming, somebody outside of Bloomington. Sure. Absolutely. I mean, our programming is good. And I would put our programming, I say with all modesty, I would put our programming up against one of the better art house theaters in New York or L.A.
Let's go back in time just a moment, even before The Writer, and tell us, Peter, about where you came from. And I mean, you're an East Coast guy. You came here for school.
I used to be an East Coast guy. I've been here too long now. When I'm in New York, I'm bumping into people all the time because I'm not moving fast enough.
Right. We all become Hoosiers in the long run. Mm.
Well, I came from Westchester County. It's one of the suburbs of New York City. And came out here to go to grad school in a master's program in English. Did some writing for some alternative magazines in town at the time. And was hearing about films in New York City from friends of mine that we weren't seeing here in Bloomington. So that's kind of where the idea came from. I talked to a couple of film programmers and the people who booked the Von Lee Theater at the time, and they kind of gave me some pointers, gave me some tips, told me who to talk to and who to call, and just gave it a whirl.
So you were a film buff, not necessarily
I wouldn't call myself a film buff. I was a film fan, but no. I mean, I know more about, I don't know, 60s rock and roll and baseball than I do movies.
Was there a moment that convinced you to do this? Back in 79, was it?
Yeah, I think it was 79. Boy, I can't remember that far back. I do remember there was a time, maybe 2 years into it, where I thought, this is working really well, and this can continue to work indefinitely. And that was, we started out showing films one night a week, so it was very small. And as a matter of fact, it was one night a week, and it was one screening a week. It was on a Wednesday night. And then we slowly expanded to maybe two screenings on that Wednesday night, and then we added a Saturday night, then we added a Friday night. And right around then, I started thinking, you know, this could work because we can show interesting films, and there's certainly an audience for it, and it works really well with the magazine in terms of them working together to increase the profile of the film series in the community.
The magazine came first, correct?
Magazine came first. Film series came about, three, 4 months later.
Were you still in grad school when all this was happening?
No, I'd stopped taking classes, and I never did get that master's.
Life took over. Yeah. Let's go back to that moment in 79, considering the culture of Bloomington at the time.
Yeah, Bloomington was the Wild West at that time. It was...
How so?
It was really anything goes.
Demographically or cultural offerings or how do you mean?
In terms of lifestyles, in terms of the way people approached their lives. I think back to the decade of the late 70s and even the first, half or two-thirds of the 80s, and I sort of cringe because in retrospect, I'm not sure exactly what I was doing on a certain level. But, you know, at the same time, that catch-as-catch-can approach to life and projects are perhaps made something like the Writer magazine, the Writer film series possible. Because we certainly didn't start off with investors in tow or anything like that. I mean, we just had to make it on our own and really make it pretty quickly, too.
Yeah.
I mean, before we published the first issue of the magazine, I went out and sold all the ads and convinced people to pay in advance so that we can pay the printing bill. I don't think we would normally do things that way today.
So just a real DIY or punk entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah,
that's exciting. So what other kinds of things were happening at the time? I mean, in terms of visual arts or the music scene?
As there are now, there were clubs. Well, there were folk singers, but there were punk bands in Bloomington. And as a matter of fact, the Gizmos, that group predated the Ramones. And their debut Bloomington album last year, after 30-some-odd years, went gold. If you include downloads, yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
I mean, I was living in the Allen Building. I don't know if you know, it's above where the Uptown Cafe is now. You know, it was kind of like, it's hard to describe, but it was a bunch of artist lofts. It was kind of like Chelsea Hotel in Bloomington. You know, there were people doing all kinds of neat stuff in studio spaces across the hall from mine and up the hall from mine, and it had a Seinfeld element to it because no one locked their doors and people just walked into other people's apartments at all hours, and as Kramer would in Seinfeld.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
I mean, it was an energetic scene there. I mean, there were a lot of people doing interesting stuff.
And so you were writing about all of these happenings in the magazine?
Yeah. Initially, actually, I was writing, as I may have mentioned, for some alternative papers in Bloomington. And that was an education in and of itself. I mean, I didn't have a background. I really didn't have any background at all in journalism. But I learned as I went along. Everybody participated. Everybody helped out in whatever way they could. So over time, I learned about layout. I learned how to cut and paste when cutting and pasting meant using an X-Acto knife and rubber cement. Sold ads, did copy editing for those publications. Drove the paper to the printer and learned how a newspaper gets printed. And then, as those publications tend to do over time, the people that were putting the most time and effort into it moved on and did other things, and they folded. And I was still here and had some ideas for how maybe something could be done a little differently, and that's when we started The Writer.
I mean, when I think back to the 80s and the explosion of desktop publishing, that wasn't until the late 80s. So we're talking about something that was happening 10 years earlier.
Right.
In terms of your publication.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you weren't doing this on a computer, in other words.
Well, no. I mean, we typeset on computers, on typographic equipment. But these were large computers that were the size of this room. But no, the magazine wasn't being created digitally.
By Quark or something.
No.
Right.
No, it was all, there were galleys, and you cut them up into strips that were 3 inches wide, and then you put rubber cement on the back, and you pasted them on a big board, and stripped photos in. I mean, it was pretty primitive, but that's just the way it was done.
Yeah, and well, speaking of technology, it's important to remember what one could access with regard to film in 1979. We didn't have Netflix.
No, we didn't. I think we may have had HBO. Did we have HBO?
Not sure. Not only that, though, we didn't, most of us, have VCRs.
Right.
That was...
Yeah, that came a little bit later.
So my point being, it was hard to see an old movie, unless you happened to catch it on TV.
That's true.
Maybe I'm pausing too much on this, but I think helping people to understand just exactly how different our cultural offerings were at that time,
Sure. Yeah.
Not only in Bloomington, but everywhere, and what you made available. So in those early years, what were some of the movies you chose, and what was your thinking in terms of your choices?
We were limited by budget, and one of the goals was to have as much variety as we could, given our somewhat limited budget. So we weren't showing contemporary movies. We weren't showing, in 1979, we weren't showing movies that were made in 1979. That came along a year or two later. So it was black and white American films from the 30s and 40s. I think our first film was His Girl Friday with Cary Grant.
Rosalind Russell.
And Rosalind Russell and Ralph Bellamy. And then we showed some classic foreign films. I'm pretty sure we showed Rules of the Game. At the end of the semester that year, we showed It's a Wonderful Life, which had never been screened in Bloomington before.
Really?
Really. Including 1946, as best I can tell, when it was released, because it was a box office failure at the time it was released. Came out right after World War II. The movie that won the Academy Award that year for Best Picture was The Best Years of Our Lives, which is a very different movie. And the feeling is that the American public really wasn't in the mood for that sort of sentimental Frank Capra sensibility.
Right.
Yeah.
So how long did it take before the film had a renaissance?
Oh, well, you know, that's interesting. It was such a flop that the copyright was not renewed. And so it fell into the public domain. And since it was in the public domain, local television stations started picking it up and showing it late at night because it was free. And that would have been sometime in the late 70s. So it was right around that same time that people started finding out about it.
Wow. And yeah. So series such as yours sort of recouped the movie and put it back into circulation and made it the just absolutely beloved cinematic experience that it is.
I mean, when we showed it the first time, most of the people there had never seen it, you know, which is kind of hard to believe. But I remember the first time Donna Reed comes on the screen, and she's playing a high school student. She's at a dance in the local high school, and people in the audience gasped because they had seen her on her television show where she played a suburban mom. But they never seen her looking like that.
Buffalo girls, won't you come out tonight? Oh, wow. That's something. I mean, that's movie history, and that's playing a role, because if you can only imagine that series and small movie houses around the country all joining together, doing the sort of thing that you did and programming in the way that you did, resuscitated the film and so many others. Along the way, and propped up films. I mean, all the way to last year when you showed the French film that didn't make it to L.A. So kudos.
Thanks.
What about, you know, growing the series and partnering with the various venues that you did along the way? I called the series a movable feast simply because the series doesn't have its own dedicated space. It exists throughout town. Yeah. How did you set that whole thing up?
Well, the first films were shown actually in what is it now? It's right on 8th and Walnut. It's closed now, but it was a club. At the time, it was called Time Out. It was owned by an IU basketball player named Archie Dees, passed away last year. Mm-hmm. And I knew the manager, and I had the idea for showing films in the club. And we did four films there, and then he sold it. So then we moved to Bear's Place right after that.
Where it remains.
Where it remains, Sunday nights, yeah.
Time for a break. This is Interstates, and we're listening to a conversation Yael Cassander had with Peter Lopilato, who founded the Rider magazine and film series here in Bloomington. Peter passed away on March 7th. After the break, we'll hear how the film series audience went from being a bar audience to people who actually wanted to see the films. Stay with us. Interstates, Alex Chambers. We're listening to an interview Yael Cassander did in 2016 with Rider film series founder Peter Lopilato. He passed away on March 7th.
What were your audiences like off the bat?
Well, years ago, you know, initially when we started, it was a bar audience. It was very much the same people who would go to the Bluebird on Friday night might come to Bear's Place on Sunday night and see a movie. It was a young audience, and it was sort of a hipster bar crowd. Now, if you come to one of our movies, more than 50% of the people there have gray hair. It's a much older audience. Mm-hmm. And it actually, that might have even been true in the 80s. I mean, the audience over just a few years evolved from one that was just interested in hanging out in a bar and whatever happened to be going on might be fine for them, to people that were really a little bit more interested in serious film.
And then you teamed up with IU, too. You show films in a number of classrooms.
Well, yeah. I mean, we screen at the IU Fine Arts theaters. There were some professors on campus who wanted their students to see at least some of the films that we were screening. And they weren't old enough to get into Bear's Place, 21 years old. So they made the arrangements for us to move the series onto campus.
As you mentioned, professors were extremely interested, probably in partnering with you mm-hmm. in terms of your programming. Now that IU Cinema is on the scene, there's a very formal relationship between professors and curricula mm-hmm. and the cinema. How do you fit into that mosaic?
Well, the Rider co-sponsors the Art House series at the IU Cinema. We've got a great relationship with the cinema. John Vickers is great to work with. And we have very similar, I think we have very similar tastes in programming. Sometimes we do some screenings together.
I remember a few years back, you co-sponsored a presentation by Crispin Glover. At the cinema when he came and showed some of his wacky movies.
Yeah, that was quite the experience.
I'm sure that you showed River's Edge and
we did show River's Edge, yeah.
So that was kind of like coming full circle, right? Mm-hmm.
Coming full circle in those terms, at least for me personally, was when Werner Herzog was at the IU Cinema. Because we screened very early on in our series, we screened his film, Aguirre, Wrath of God. And if you had told me, you know, some whatever year that would have been, 1982 or thereabouts, that years later I would be standing next to him at the back of at the cinema, in this case, watching the film with him, you know.
Well, it's exciting that Werner Herzog and Crispin Glover and John Sayles mm-hmm. and Whit Stillman and Penelope Spheeris and Spike Lee and so many filmmakers are coming through Bloomington and that we're really on the map.
And really, there are so many more than that. I mean, that's sort of the A-list. But, you know, there are two or three filmmakers every week at the IU Cinema.
Yeah, and it seems to me between cinema, between what you're doing and the fledgling film festival, the Middle Coast mm-hmm. Film Festival, and some of the filmmakers who are trying to make things happen here, that Bloomington is sort of on the map nationally? I mean, how would you talk about it?
Well, I think we certainly are. I think the visiting filmmakers who come here speak very favorably of it after they leave. I'm sure they do. I mean, people are certainly more aware of Bloomington and more of a movie scene than 10 years ago.
I know you regularly attend the True False Festival in Columbia, Missouri.
Yeah, they know about it.
And so how would you say Bloomington compares, say, to a town of comparable size in terms of its film culture?
It's interesting. The programming here, the programming at the cinema, is exceptional. It's better than the programming at any other comparable theater. It really is. However, the film audience here is a little bit different. You know, I don't know. I'm not real sure why that is. But when you ask about film culture, it's here. It might not be as large as some other college towns that have more urban populations. It's not just Bloomington versus Columbia, Missouri, either. It's not just Bloomington versus Ann Arbor or Madison. I mean, it's really the, you know, it's more than that. It's just the whole, look, I talk to 18 and 19-year-old students, okay? I had this conversation about 4 or 5 months ago with an intern. So it would have been February, and I asked her, I said to her, have you seen any of the Best Picture nominees? And she said, well, no, I haven't, Peter. I've been really busy lately, and I haven't had a chance to download them. First of all, it never occurred to her that I was talking about seeing them in a movie theater. And then, secondly, these films were in commercial distribution, so they weren't available for download. Unless, of course, you spend time in the netherworld of the dark web. And then that's what she was talking about. And I think that's true of a lot of my projectionists. They watch movies that way all the time. And I think that's true of a lot of college students.
That's sad.
Yeah, it is sad. I mean, again, you know, I had another conversation with another intern. And we were talking about, this is a few years ago. I think Antonioni and maybe Ingmar Bergman died within a week of each other. And I was talking to her about, oh, yeah, back in the 70s when people went to the cinema and then they went to a cafe afterwards and they talked about the movie. And she said, well, Peter, people still do that. They just talk in chat rooms.
How about that? I mean, let's talk about the collective film experience.
It's still there. And it's disingenuous for me to say, well, it's not still there for the, you know, the movie that won the Best Picture at Cannes. Maybe it's not. But just because tastes have changed in terms of, I mean, I could talk to you for 30 minutes about why foreign films today are not as hip as they were 25 or 30 years ago. But people still go to movies. So whether it's the Harry Potter series or whether it's the newest Jason Bourne movie, people still go to films. Mm-hmm. And they still go to films in pretty large numbers.
Well, hence the graying of your audience.
Mm-hmm.
So would it be accurate to state, based on what you're saying, that the audience, at least in Bloomington, Indiana, for so-called art house or international or repertory films is not renewing itself?
It's more challenging to get it to renew itself. And maybe the right way to answer that is to say that I have to a little bit more actively help them to renew it. You know, years ago, we showed films on 16-millimeter film. We had clunky projectors and reels of film. We're much more portable now than we were then. So we can go to different locations on campus and screen films in student lounges and really anywhere. You know, micro theaters are popping up everywhere.
Mm-hmm. So you really have to be an ambassador for the film experience.
Well, I've always been an ambassador for the film experience, but yeah, perhaps a little bit more so.
Keeping any business going for 37 years is really impressive. Have there been moments when you wanted to throw in the towel or felt like you were going to have to?
Once a week.
How's that?
I mean, you know, nobody gets rich showing foreign language films and documentaries. Otherwise, everybody'd be doing it. But having said that, I enjoy the movies and I thoroughly enjoy what I do. And, you know, one of the things that makes it worthwhile is, it's nice when you get, and this happened a few weeks ago. I got an email from somebody and I didn't know him. And he said, I saw a movie at your film series about 25 years ago involving a nasty dog. And I've been trying to find that movie, and I can't remember it.
Wow.
And so I was able to answer his question. Yeah. He was very happy about that. Or, you know, when somebody just stops you on the street and says, hey, Peter, I saw that movie last week, and I really liked it. Or I read an article in a magazine and really appreciated that. So, yeah, sure, that's what makes it worthwhile.
Those kinds of connections.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, at this point, 37 years later and still going strong, I would beg you to consider the question that the angel Clarence asks George Bailey in the film.
Yeah.
What would have happened had you not done this?
Oh, someone else would have done it. Bloomington. Bloomington would be exactly the same. Someone else would have done it.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Well, you did have a near-death experience at one point. Would you tell us the story?
There's the parking garage on 6th Street across the street from the Runcible Spoon was being built. And the street was open to traffic, and I was driving down the street, and a large piece of cement fell from a crane onto my car while I was driving. It was, well, it weighed 22 tons. It was actually intended to be one of the ramps that cars would drive on. What had happened was the crane operator had lost control of the crane, and he just dropped it. He didn't realize, he thought the street was closed off. And it wasn't. And had I been in the back seat, I probably wouldn't be here speaking to you, but...
But you were driving.
Yeah, I was driving, and I was pretty lucky. I mean, the car, was crushed. Every window was completely shattered. And they had to cut me out with the jaws of life.
I heard that you had a cappuccino in your hand.
I don't think I had a cappuccino in my hand.
And that you didn't spill it.
That's urban legend. No. No, I didn't have a cappuccino in my hand. I was very fortunate. I mean, I didn't have a scratch on me. I mean, I took off my shoes and my shoes were filled with shards of glass. You know, my hair was filled with shards of glass. But I was perfectly fine. The scariest part was I was in the car for maybe 30 minutes or so before they got me out, and I was lying flat on the seat because the ceiling, the roof of the car was crushed in. When the beam first landed on the car, I mean, everything got dark because it was a sunny day and this large beam just completely covered the car. And it actually, I was told later that the car actually was kind of like an accordion effect, where it went down and bounced back up and then came down again. There were three different times where the roof caved in a little bit more. So it was like that. And each time that happened, it was pretty scary. But
do you remember any thoughts from that?
Yeah, I do remember thoughts. I was trying to concentrate on anything else. So I was going through my utility bills in my head and which ones I'd paid and which ones I hadn't.
The important stuff.
Yeah. And then I was trying to remember the last time I'd looked at the batting averages in the American and National League. And I was trying to see if I could just list the players, the top 10 players, that sort of thing. And it's kind of hard to describe, but I mean, on the one hand, I felt pretty calm. And I had the presence of mind to turn off the ignition. But on the other hand, I think I was probably terrified.
Wow. It's so interesting that you went to such utterly prosaic thoughts in that moment. You weren't thinking...
What, batting averages?
Oh, sorry. That's very important. Well, what I understand, though, speaking of legend, is that your experience spawned quite a legend. The story was picked up on the AP wire. Is that correct? Tell me about the publicity that you received.
It was the worst publicity imaginable. It really was. I was getting calls from people from all over the country who thought I had been saved for a reason. And one woman wanted to pitch a tent in my backyard.
You got a lot of fan mail?
I wouldn't call it fan mail.
So was this a before and after kind of thing for you?
No. Was it a life-changing experience?
Yeah.
Not really. After I got out of the car, I said to myself, well, apparently I've survived this. And I probably shouldn't have. So I thought, okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to stop putting stuff off.
Well, we're glad you survived the incident, Peter. And what would Bloomington be without you? Anyway, I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
That was writer, film series, and magazine founder Peter Lopilato in conversation with Yael Cassander. Peter passed away on March 7th. You've been listening to Interstates from WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. If you have a story for us or you've got some sound we should hear, let us know at wfiu.org/interstates. Okay, we've got your quick moment of slow radio coming up, but first, the credits. Interstates is produced and edited by me, Alex Chambers, with Avi Forrest. Our social media master is Jillian Blackburn. We get support from Eabon Binder, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Sam Sheminara, Peyton Whaley, and Kate Young. Our executive producer is Eric Bolstridge. Our theme song is by Amy Olsner and Justin Vollmer. Music for The Netmaker's Story by Mark Chilla and Amy Olsner. We have additional music from the artists at Universal Production Music. All right, time for some found sound. That was a muddy late winter hike at Griffey Lake in Bloomington, Indiana. Until next week, I'm Alex Chambers. Thanks, as always, for listening.